So we talked about this in the first interview, that it's very important that really wealthy people understand that they are going to be desert here. They are going to be taken apart and lose everything. But it's also very important that all the people that think that they have a business that they are protecting by being silent about this, that ultimately they are going to have a big problem.
Hey guys, I'm back with David Webb, a prior big hedge fund manager and financial expert, and I met him in Sweden last year and an astonishing talk about the Great Taking, and he has a free book of that name, which I'll put the link down below. But I was not aware of this, even though I thought I was aware of most of the skullduggery in the modern world and geopolitical intrigues. And it's an astonishing story. And I managed to catch up with him again on Zoom. And we're going to go through the developments since last year on what's happening with the Great Taking. And, you know, senators are getting involved and high net worth individuals are becoming aware of this threat to all of our kind of possessions and securities. So we're going to check in now on what's been going on. Fascinating story. So great to see you again, David.
Hi, Ivar. Thank you. And I want to say that interview you did with me was literally the first time that I spoke with anyone about it. And it really was very significant for me personally. And it really did a lot to begin to break this open and spread it.
Oh, that's excellent. No, thanks, David. But again, this is what I love doing, is just getting out the reality of what's going on that people won't see in mainstream. And it was similar for Dr. Jacob Nordengaard. I helped get his message out on the history of the Rockefeller Foundation and how it led to WEF, UN, and all the stuff that's going on. So that's the whole idea. And, you know, I thought we might, because I can put the link below to our prior interview, which was excellent and very pithy, and only around 25 minutes and covered all the key things. But I thought we might, for 5 minutes, you might just go through this 50, 70 year history of this threat to our securities in just bullet points. And then we get on to the latest.
Yes. Okay. Well, for 400 years, securities, stocks and bonds were personal property. And that is no longer the case. People will be surprised to learn that. This was subverted over a period of 50 plus years. It began with dematerialization of securities. That was not necessarily a problem. It was a precondition for what has happened, because Sweden, for example, dematerialized. All G30 nations were pushed fairly early on to dematerialize, but Sweden implemented it in a way to make sure that people had their property rights to securities. So there's no reason that electronic record keeping can't be used to know who owns what. So then there was a second level of subversion, which was to create this concept of a security entitlement, which never existed in centuries of securities law. This was done in 1994 with an amendment to the Uniform Commercial Code in the US. And then this could be done at the state level. So it was quietly implemented in all 50 states by the end of the 90s. And this security entitlement turns your, you know, quote unquote ownership into a contractual claim to your property, which gives you a very weak standing in the event of insolvency in the financial system or of your broker or intermediaries. So you really are then an unsecured creditor. These securities are all held in these enormous pools. In the U.S., it's in Depository Trust Corp. And there are similar things in Europe. The thing is that the collateral in these pools can be used without restriction and without payment, free of payment, by entities further up in the food chain, so to speak, in the financial system. So the public's collateral is being used all the time in underpinning the derivatives complex globally. So this is where it is going. And what I would explain, the sleight of hand here is that so the collateral is underpinning derivatives contracts, which are contracts. Contracts historically would have had no priority claim in a bankruptcy of an intermediary or at some level in the financial system. They were contracts. They would be unsecured creditors. Property holders had the right to their own property for centuries. If the intermediary failed, you would say, "I'm sorry, you're out of business. Here's where you transfer my property." And if they didn't, that was theft. It was criminal. So what they've done by turning the property, converting the property right to securities into a contractual claim, that then severs the it puts the public in a very weak standing. And then at the other end of the food chain, these derivative contracts, which never would have had a standing, the secured creditors behind those contracts are given a super priority claim to what is in these pools. This is the sleight of hand to sever the property right at one end and to give a super priority claim to just the biggest banks at the other end.
Yeah. And, you know, the classic JP Morgan and Chase and the big players up the top that are also hoovering up small banks as all the corruption and Fed policy leads to, and mouse click money printing, etc. As that leads to instabilities, bank fails, the smaller banks are being hoovered up. And ultimately, in the event of a massive failure, our securities now legally, as you described, that for hundreds of years were truly ours. We were the primary owner in the event of a problem. Our stuff came back to us. So mortgages or, bank balances, stocks and bonds we own through brokers, all of these different securities, they've cleverly now over many decades switched it that we're not the real owner in the event of a problem, that the big banks and the guys up top and the derivatives people, they're the real owner. And we have a claim, so we might get a percentage back if there's a problem. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, well, the way we know this, I'll mention this, it's important that we know this irrefutably from a document that I've included in full in the appendix to the book. It's that important. This is a response of the Federal Reserve to something called the Legal Certainty Group, which was operating in Europe in the mid-2000s. 2000, I think they're getting underway in 2004. The response was in 2006. So, in the lead up to the financial crisis, the last great financial crisis. So this the Legal Certainty Group was tasked with studying how to conform European law to this model of law in the US, but also to assure what they mean by legal certainty is to assure that the secured creditors take the client assets. It's as simple as that. That's what it's about. So they were asking the Federal Reserve, how did you guys do this? Explain it to us. So it's very clear, it's very pointed, it is irrefutable because the response was prepared by lawyers at the New York Fed, which is really the power center of the Federal Reserve System. So in this, it's explained the pooled nature of the securities and how this operates, that whatever happens, you only get a pro rata share of what's left in the pool. And after the secured creditors take what they the securities that they have used as collateral, which is essentially all of it. And so you only get a pro rata share after they take what they are going to take. And that is true. The Fed explains that that is the case even for quote unquote segregated accounts. Now, this is the shocking thing for sophisticated institutional investors, that is difficult for them to, they don't want to acknowledge it, that there is no true segregation, even for pension plans or large sophisticated investment funds or hedge funds or any kind of entity, is not truly segregated. The segregation is only in the books and records at the lowest level of the system. Meanwhile, the property is transferred from that level to a higher level where it is held in pooled form. So this, I'm speaking to what you were saying about, you only get a smidge of what's left. That's how that works. And it's even for the biggest, most sophisticated entities.
There was just one quick thing I remember from the first interview, and we will quickly then get on to the latest developments, but a couple of quick things. One was, of course, it's very important high net worth individuals understand this, because very wealthy people figure, well, they're above the trials and tribulations of ordinary people who might have problems with, bank crashes, because they're safe and they've got all their securities, tons of them. But they are just as exposed, unless you're up the top, JP Morgan, even high net worth are exposed. But the other thing was a proof point. You mentioned after the financial crash that this was proved out in law, I think in New York State after the crash, where certain creditors were wiped out and a judge deemed, according to the new rules, that yes, the stuff could be taken. What?
Well, this was the Lehman Brothers case. I think it's really may have been the purpose of bankrupting Lehman, was to demonstrate the case law and that they can do this. And now people get confused about Lehman because they say, well, the retail accounts were returned to people. This case that I cite in the book is about sophisticated institutional entities, mainly in London, Lehman London, where their collateral, which they intended to use, I mean, you're in a financial meltdown, they're in a crisis, they need their own collateral to use during the crisis. And unbeknownst to them, Lehman was using their collateral. So when Lehman, which normally does not come to light, but in a bankruptcy it comes to light, because now their collateral was taken. Now, who was it taken by? It was taken by JP Morgan, which was the custodian for their assets and also the secured creditor that took their assets. So it was something that prior to these revisions to what's called safe harbor would have been illegal, or let's say the assets would have been clawed back by the receiver and returned to the clients. But here they are in this bankruptcy case, 5 years after the failure of Lehman, still trying to get their assets back. It would have been nice to have that collateral during the crisis. Now, the people that say, well, the retail accounts, those were recovered. Well, yes, the retail business of Lehman was sold to Barclays, I think it was Barclays. And or may no, it wasn't Barings, that's an older one. I think it was Barclays. And that happened maybe some weeks or months after the bankruptcy filing. And people are collapsing events and thinking that that meant that the system worked fine. No, because all accounts, including all retail accounts, were frozen in the bankruptcy when Lehman filed bankruptcy. This is completely different than what would have happened before these changes in law. And now think about it. You were in a terrible financial collapse, and your account is frozen, and you have no idea when you will or if you will ever get access to it again. And so when people have pointed this out, I've said, look, imagine that your car was stolen. And after weeks or months or years, the police return something kind of like your car. Does that mean that your car was not stolen? If you eventually get something back. Now, the other thing about that Lehman case is the only reason there was recovery was they inflated the bubble again. And it took years. Much of the recovery wasn't for 13 years. But the entire case demonstrated this potential to take all of the property. As it turns out, some of it was returned.
Yeah, but that's no commiseration or whatever. Yeah, it's crazy because that property, that collateral, the owners were under the impression that in a collapse they would get that back because it was not put on the casino table. It was not being played. It was collateral, but
They
they
were
didn't for
not,
me.
these were unlevered assets. They had not borrowed against these assets. That's what people have to understand. This is a means of taking what would have been property, what people understood to be their property, and property that is owned free and clear. That's what's very different about this versus what happened in the Great Depression, for example, when people lost everything because they had borrowed against it. And that will happen in a that's the good old-fashioned way of taking. And that will happen again when we have the next major collapse.
Yeah, for sure. No, this is, and again, for the listener, these are securities you own. You are not playing them. They are there for your pension, for your future, for your children. You own them. You are not gambling. You are not leveraging against them. That's exactly what we're talking about. It is being gambled and used as collateral
By a third party,
by a
by
third
a third party without your
party.
knowledge.
That's it. So we might get on then to, and actually, I often mention I've done a few videos on this about physical gold and owning physical gold, both against inflation and certainly against this kind of craziness, is a really good idea. And I have links at the back end of this discussion on how you can do that with a reputable company. But people really need to start thinking about that is what they own and what is subject to this abomination that we're discussing and what can be kept separate or move more of your assets separate to this exposure, I guess.
Yes. Well, I think it's important for people to diversify in ways that they haven't thought about.
Just a quick interlude here, guys, seeing as we're talking about physical gold, something very close to my heart and that of my family for our future. So I've linked up with Pure Gold in London, and there's a link I have now with them where you get a year's free storage. While you're working out exactly how to play this kind of diversification, I would generally recommend having the physical possession. And I know David talks about, the 1930s takeaway of gold by the US government, but that was back when gold was backing the currency. We're in a very different position now. So basically, the central banks are piling up on gold. It's been moved in 2019 to a tier one asset alongside the dollar, the only other tier one asset in the financial world by the Bank of International Settlements, and the BRICS countries are all piling up as well. So now is the time to hedge and have some physical gold in one's possession. Not everything, but certainly a percentage of your wealth or your future or your pension. And I think it's just a really great idea, and I can stand over that personally. So the link is there if you wish to think about this, does a free consultation with Pure Gold's kind of experts. And it's not all about gold. They'll talk in general about diversification and your financial situation. So a really useful resource. Anyway, it's there for anyone who wants to take advantage. And now back to the chat with David, which I hope you'll agree is quite fascinating.
I point out in the book that gold was the principal collateral underpinning in the when they closed the banks in 1933. And there was rationale for confiscating the gold of the U.S. public on the argument that they needed the gold as backing in order to expand credit. This time around, gold is not the principal collateral backing. It's all your securities. So perhaps gold will be not the first thing taken in this, but my warning to people is that if they are allowed to run unhindered with this scheme, they will eventually get around taking everything. So there's really ultimately no place to hide, because what they did in the 30s, they claimed they needed to confiscate the gold so they could expand credit, but then they did not expand credit. They kept conditions very tight. They kept people in a situation where they could not pay off their debts, so they lost everything. But so why did they confiscate the gold? It was so that the public would not be able to use the gold. It's so the public would not be able to run a parallel system or an alternative system. So let me step back and explain that. So I just recently visited G. Edward Griffin in California, which was like a pilgrimage for me to meet him. And a great man.
And he wrote, I could be wrong here, but The Creature from Jekyll Island, right?
Yeah, he wrote Creature from Jekyll Island, which I, oddly enough, had not read until after I wrote this book. I mean, I read it just in the last couple of months. And I knew about it, but I knew about all this stuff from my own father. That was the beginning of my interest in it, and then from my own work. So I knew about it from going into it myself with the kind of clues I had from my dad. but anyway, G. Edward Griffin in Creature from Jekyll Island, he talks about the people that were present at the planning meeting there, which was in 1910, and he has gone into everything written about this and their own memoirs and statements about it, which I have not done, but he's done that. And he has described that their principal objective in planning this was to take control comprehensively of the banking system. Their concern was that the highest growth in banking was in banks outside their control. It was mainly in the West and the South of the US, and also industry in the US was doing so well that it was self-financing, so it did not need their credit. So what did they do? They, and I think we can understand this with the perspective of history, that they literally destroyed the U.S. economy to establish their comprehensive control. So the act was, Federal Reserve Act was put in place essentially on Christmas Eve of 2013, quietly. And then
1913,
and then World War One began 8 or 9 months later. And what these central banks are always joined at the hip with warfare. because it creates the massive debt escalation. So World War I fueled enormous global debt. Now, what the Federal Reserve did there, and the Bank of England was created the same way to fund warfare. But what they do is they create the money out of thin air to buy the government debt. Now, what that does is it just dilutes everyone else's purchasing power. So, a simple example, let's say you have a dollar, and then the Federal Reserve creates $2. What that means is they now have twice the purchasing power you did. and you have a third of the purchasing power you did before. That's how they get this incredible power, but also they are charging interest on the money they've created out of thin air to buy the treasury debt. So the treasury debt could have been issued directly by the treasury. And then any interest being paid would essentially be to the people of the country that issued the debt by inserting themselves as a private central bank and then kicking off a war with massive escalation debt. That's what gives them a power over the government and of all society that is unshakable from that point. So they're being paid this incredible amount of money. Essentially, it's an extraction from all of the efforts of everyone in the society being paid to these people on money they created out of nothing. Then they use the treasury bonds as their capital to lever up the banking system 10 to 1 on top of that and make loans to the public. So it's all done without any capital of their own in this. So so World War I, then you have a bubble and bust. They created a, so it happened in fairly short order from the end of World War I, a bubble in the 20s, the bust beginning in 29, and then a comprehensive tightening of economic conditions and the closure. So the closure of the banks, they literally put out of business all of their competitors over weekend, so that the only banks that reopened were the Federal Reserve banks and their selected banks that were within their system. Then confiscating the gold from the public fits in this because they did not want an alternative system. It was about having that there was no recourse but the credit creation of their banks. And that's what we've been ever since in ever since. Same thing happened with the Bank of England. It is like a coup that puts them in place to control everything. And that's why, cycling back to the situation we have here with, whether it's gold or Bitcoin, I think it makes sense to diversify and have different things. But my message to these very wealthy people, all the way to the top of the system, is you cannot hide from this. Ultimately, they are coming for everything. So what they did in the 30s, one of the apologists for the Fed writing about this calls it a regime shifting policy. And it certainly was. It established the Federal Reserve System in a completely in with total power over the government, over the society, and something that has not been possible to challenge. Although I think we have to get to that.
Yeah, for sure. And we will, of course, get now to some of the developments and the awareness. But absolutely, I mean, gold is a hedge. against inflation and against this stuff. But ultimately, if something doesn't stop them, they'll remorselessly go in a spiral to, and they almost can't stop themselves. It's like got such a momentum. As you said, this thing 50, 60 years ago that started to take all ownership, true ownership of securities away from the people and up to the head of the Hydra. The people who started this are now dead. So it's handed on to generation to generation. It's almost like inexorable. They almost cannot stop themselves just going through this plan and strategy of a century. And if someone doesn't step in and just wake people up against this, it'll inexorably continue until there's an absolute cataclysmic mess. And I think that's beginning now. Some of the recent things you sent me about senators' letters and some court cases in certain states, this is beginning to see the light of day.
Yes. Well, it's not happening at the federal level, and it's not happening at the EU level, for example. I think what has to happen, this was done by subverting local law in every case. So it was done at the state level. In Europe, it was done at the nation, the level of the nation. So that is where the law would need to be reverted. And it can be done because these changes to the law are shockingly simple and easy to see once you look at them. And that process is beginning. So I have on the website for the Great Taking, there is an action button, action with an exclamation mark, explaining that this process is beginning in the States, in the US, and with some links to some organizations that are working on this. And one is the Pro-Life Legislative Network, and another is the Heartland Foundation. But there are other people involved as well. And you'll see a letter that they have prepared, basically a call to action that has been signed by some people. And but the main thing is that a bill was actually introduced in the legislature in South Dakota. And now what that bill would have done is to give, it's very simple, give back a priority claim to investors to their own assets. It's as simple as that, to make it very clear that that's what we're doing here. And now the way it was subverted in the state law is the section, this is Article 8 in the UCC, that you'll see a paragraph that says that entitlement holders, remember, this is now the word for the investor, the entitlement holder. So it is a contractual claim, but it says that the entitlement holders have priority over the secured creditors. It says that. And this is what was shown to people at the time that the amendments were made in 1994. It was claimed that this was done to assure property rights to investors. But they left out that it then goes on to say, except. Now, the same thing was done in these hearings in South Dakota. The so-called experts that spoke would only read the first paragraph. And then, but if you go to the except, so this is the subterfuge, the except then refers to another section. Then when you go to that second section, it says the same thing. It says that the investors have priority over the secured creditors a second time. Then there's another except. You have to go nested down three levels. And at the third level, you find that if the secured creditors have control, and we'll talk about what that means, if the secured creditors have control, they have priority over the investors. It's as simple as that. That's what has to be struck from this. There cannot be that exception. Now, what does it mean to have control? We're in a condition now. Well, let me say, when we had paper certificates, there was a bright line as to who had control. If I have my certificate, I have control. If I've signed it over to you, you have control. So there is a very clear, bright line as to who has control. Now, this was the purpose of the dematerialization and what's called the indirect holding system. Once they're dematerialized, it's very fuzzy, or it can be made fuzzy, who has control. The clients think that they own their securities, but in fact, control only means that the party has the power to sell it, the interest. And in the indirect holding system, the financial intermediaries always have the power to sell the security, and they can transfer that power to sell the security. So 100% of the time, control resides with some entity other than the owner. So 100% of the time, control is elsewhere. So that exception means that they have priority all the time in an indirect holding system. 100% of the time, everywhere, it's easily done. It's only a question of what entity within that system has the control at that time. So they it is passed to an entity as collateral for so the intermediary has control, but then they pass it to as collateral. They use the collateral and it passes to another entity, but it's being used all the time. The second exception, so there are two exceptions. The second is that if the secured creditor is a creditor of a clearing corporation, those creditors have priority all the time. Now, what is a central clearing counterparty where all the derivatives are housed? They are clearing corporations. So the secured creditors there, where the collateral has been transported and used, those creditors have priority all the time under the UCC. So the simple change would have been just to strike that and make it clear you cannot use this collateral, even without changing the concept of an entitlement, which could be, I think ultimately we should get back to saying, look, this is property. We're going to do away with this idea of an entitlement, but it would have been a very quick, easy, straightforward change to just revert the priority. So seeing this in a bill, an actual bill, it was Bill 1199 in South Dakota, made this very real for people that this is in fact the case. And it drew attention to the subterfuge in the language, how it's done in the UCC. So this was very important. And I went to South Dakota. So after seeing Ed Griffin, I went to South Dakota, and I was both with Ed Griffin and with and in South Dakota. I was there with James Patrick, who did Planet Lockdown and Nitrogen 2000. So he has documented a lot of this. So what they did was they went through a number of, basically the banking lobby came down on this hard, as you can imagine, full force, full force. They did not want this happening. And they are very well equipped. And they have the people they control in the legislature. So there was quite a bit of support for this in the legislature. But of course, there are key people that are controlled by the banking lobby, and the first thing was to the legislation had it was referred to committee, and they referred it to the State Affairs Committee, which I was told is the place that it would be killed. That's why they did that. And there were 13 people on the committee. One of the people who would have been a supporter was out with surgery. What they did, their experts stood up and, as I explained here, just cited part of the code, to create the impression that this is fine. The rights of investors are being protected here. So they that this was grossly misleading, factually incorrect testimony. But the committee was run in such a way that it was difficult to rebut that in the meeting. That was a problem. This is how they do things. There was another process run by the proponents, the supporters of this, to force the bill back onto the floor. They got enough votes in the legislature to do that. And so there was a second, unfortunately, it wasn't a full hearing. They didn't allow a hearing of it on the floor. They had another procedure to decide if it could be scheduled to be heard on the floor. And when they, so this, there are a number of levels you have to go through. And again, in this case, they prevented any rebuttal. The proponents of the bill could just say, please allow this to be heard. Basically that. Now, I've listened to all this, and I think there is a way to attack that because for example, one of the lobbyists, one of the for the banks, was spreading to the members completely false statements before this vote, and so there was no opportunity to address that. There's a letter that was done by Don Grande, who is or Grandy is the pronunciation. So Don Grandy is a great attorney. We have this going for us. He's in North Dakota, but he is advising all of these state efforts now. I have worked with lots of attorneys over my life, and Don is absolutely perfect for this. He is very crisp. He understands exactly what to do. There's no wasted motion. And he thoroughly knows the Uniform Commercial Code. So he's the guy. So in about an hour before the vote, we learned that this lobbyist was spreading basically lies to the legislators to subvert the vote. So the proponents weren't allowed to say anything about this in the meeting, but and we'll come back to that. But he wrote this, Don Grandy wrote this letter to send to Julie Auk, who was the sponsor of the bill. I'll read it. Rep. Auk, I have learned that your colleagues are being told that House Bill 1163, the UCC 2022 amendment, protects South Dakota investors. It does not. This is at best a lie. So what they had done was implemented another UCC change as a kind of subterfuge. It was used. Now, there may be reasons for it. It has something to do with cryptocurrency, but by having enacted that, they used it as a smokescreen to say, well, if you enact this bill, it will be in conflict with the bill we've just enacted. And the bill we've just enacted protects investors. This is the story they were saying. So as Don Grandy is saying, it does not. It is at best a lie. House Bill 1163 amendments to South Dakota's UCC deal, primarily with UCC Article 9, secured transactions. Article 9 has nothing to do with investments. Anyone saying otherwise should not be trusted. And it goes on, but basically he is calling this out in no uncertain terms, but there was no opportunity to introduce that or discuss it. So I've watched this. I think what one would have to do, now this is what we have going for us. These are just bold-faced, flat out lies. And the reality of it is so absolutely clear if you just look at the language in the code. The problem is getting to the point of being able to do so. So what would you have to do? There was plenty of evidence that these lies had occurred in the hearing. There was plenty of evidence that the lies were occurring outside the hearing, essentially tampering with the legislators. So what the proponents need to do is on the floor, they only get a chance to say a couple of sentences. They must immediately say there is evidence of misleading and factually incorrect statements that have been made by the banking lobby, and to specifically say the banking lobby, and the people of South Dakota deserve to have a full hearing of this. That you have to say that before you're stopped from speaking, and then it will be heard. And so that's what we need to do going forward. You use whatever you have to aggressively attack these lies right off the bat, because they lie aggressively when they get a chance to speak. They lie aggressively, so we have to confront that given any chance to speak. We learned a lot from what happened in South Dakota. Now, there is also a similar process running in Tennessee right now. So that is still going. And there may be, six other states where this process can get underway as well. So there are 50 states. We just have to get one. But even this process in South Dakota had very important exposition, both in terms of the reality of what is in the UCC, that this is real, that it's very simple to understand how it operates, and to see that a bill can be introduced to reverse this and how easily that would be done, and also to see the tactics of the banking lobby and to then deal with that better in the future.
That is so important, David, of course, to force them out into the light. And although they're making sure that the light is kind of shadowed on them and using lies and obfuscation, still great to see their tactics. And they probably have limited numbers of lies in a sense that can be successful. They were successful this time. But if they're cornered in other states and those lies are kind of countered in advance or teed up against those lies, they won't have infinite lies to draw on, you know, so they could get cornered. Florida springs to mind instinctively as a state that might might be interested in doing something about this? What do you think?
Florida, Texas, it depends on their legislative calendar. Not all of them are in session this year. So if it's not next year or this year, it might be next year.
The key link, I suppose, I'll put down below is the Great Taking, your website. The free book is in there prominently. And the new thing is the action with an exclamation mark tab to get into the detail of the actual current events, as you described so well here, and what else is going on and what good groups are beginning to become aware and get involved to help, I don't know, to help counter this insanity. Otherwise, we'll spiral into God knows what madness in the future, right?
Yes, it's, if this can be reverted in even one state in the U.S., it is the beginning. If this can be changed in the U.S., the whole world changes.
I was going to say, and I know we kind of a hard stop, but if one state does it, I'm kind of curious. That's a huge thing, of course, because then you've set a precedent for other states to see that something like this is required. The lies become harder to snowstorm it, and it's fantastic. But if only a certain number of states had this law put in, it would kind of spancel the system. I mean, how much trouble would a few states cause in this broader system? They want no exceptions. That's why they hoovered up the last two countries you described in our last interview. I think Finland and Sweden all had to be on board.
Yes.
But if you have a few states that have a legal kind of opt-out of this madness, how much trouble is that for them?
Well, I think it's, first of all, it's very important because this action in South Dakota is literally the first place in the world where anything like this has happened to expose it and push back against it. So it's a beginning. The jurisdiction that succeeded in this and then has a legal basis for asserting that you cannot take the customer collateral, that should bring lots of support to that jurisdiction. It should work for that jurisdiction. You see, what they try to do is frighten. This is another tactic of the banking lobby, is they say it will be bad for the business environment if you change this. And it would be quite the opposite. So it is a beginning of the rollback. There's another thing I want to mention that's very important, that it's an idea that came up when I was in South Dakota. I woke up one morning and this was in my head. And the representative Julie Auk is a registered rep, and part of her concern is that she will have liability for this if her customers are hurt. That she's a conscientious person, but she knows that the liability will rest with me if my customers lose all their assets and I did not warn them about this or put them in that position. So now when you think about that, it's true of the entire financial services industry with this. So this is the image that popped into my mind. We know that with in the Middle Ages, with these castle towns, the Lord sits up in a castle on the hill, and the townspeople are settled in a kind of skirt all around the approach to the castle. And inside the town walls, and the townspeople think that they are being protected. The reality is they are there to provide a buffer for the Lord on the hill. Any marauders are going to have to go through the townspeople before they get to the castle keep. That is what the financial services industry is now. The This is a model they use over and over again. They've done it with the whole pharmaceuticals thing as well, where all the providers of the vaccines are exposed to the liability while they are not, the pharmaceutical companies and the people that orchestrated this whole thing. So the little people are set up to be the patsies over and over again. So it was done with the vaccine. And in this case, the little people are the brokers and even what we think of as powerful organizations, but they are not going to be protected. They're going to be a lot of angry people, and they're going to go after the people that put them into these investments that they've lost. So another part of this that's very important is to make people in the financial services industry aware that they have been made patsies in this and get, as I say, the shit rolling uphill here instead of downhill. It's got to go back in the other direction. So we talked about this in the first interview, that it's very important that really wealthy people understand that they are going to be desert here. They are going to be taken apart and lose everything. But it's also very important that all the people that think that they have a business that they are protecting by being silent about this, that ultimately they are going to have a big problem. So we then get increasing numbers of people that become activated.
Activism from and all the way up to very significant net worth and significant companies that realize, I mean, what you described there, David, the smart and evil, let's be honest, guys who are up the top, who've orchestrated this over a half century, they've kind of created a series of concentric circles of kind of cannon fodder. And yeah, you may be on a higher circle, Dante's circles of hell, you may be higher up, but it'll come for you ultimately. But the genius of these cannon fodder circles is that they'll be fighting amongst each other while you sit, or the bad guys sit, kind of way up at the top, almost insulated from all the infighting and chaos that their system has created. But if awareness gets out and everyone, or broadly on all the layers, begins to, and I've said this so many times with COVID and everything else, just begins to look up and see where it emanates from.
Yes.
That's all we need, because then you'll get more unity and you'll get concerted focus on where the actual root cause of the problem came from. That's it.
And the root cause is the central banking power.
Yes.
That is what controls everything. And people that are worried about what has been put into our bodies, what's in our food, all the different DARPA programs to infiltrate our bodies with nanoparticles that can then be all, which is real. They've actually, I've seen it. They've funded like five different studies to do that. All of that stuff, it will only go on if it has funding. If the funding is stopped, all of this stuff that is aimed at us stops. And so if you are tired of being threatened and you believe these threats are real, and they are, then the only way to stop it is to stop the central bank funding of all of this, then the funding of the wars. And I want to say that the central banks are joined at the hip with warfare. We're now in open-ended hybrid war. It's going to intensify, and that's always their go-to thing. But the other thing that the central banks are joined at the hip with is totalitarianism. And we have to face up to this. They are not capitalists. They do not believe in free market capitalism. They do not believe in in autonomy in making economic decisions. They believe in central planning and control. So the central banks have funded literally every totalitarian regime. So they funded, they funded the Bolsheviks, for example. There are pictures, Ed Griffin shows this, of the people from New York, the bankers, dressed in military uniform, riding around in military vehicles in Bolshevik Russia. And they, so the murder of the Tsar and his family, and chopping them up in little bits and throwing them down a mine shaft, all of that was done with the support and funding, which continued from the banking interests. And then they did the same thing with the Nazi Party, the rise of National Socialism. One of the things I've read recently is Friedrich Hayek's Road to Serfdom, which was my grandfather's copy, I believe, and it was printed in 1944. And Hayek is warning that while the war will end and the Nazis will be defeated, the problem is that the people running Britain are the same people. He's warning about that in no uncertain terms. The Fabians founded the Stockholm School of Economics. This is not some fringe group. People like Gordon Brown and Tony Blair are their boys. And so they believe in central planning and total control. And Hayek points out that the real world is so complex that it cannot be centrally planned. If your objective is to meet unmet human needs and human happiness, you need constantly organizing autonomous units and decision making to do that. But that's not their objective. Human happiness is not their objective. So we.
Exactly, and that's so absolutely spot on, David. Their objective is power and control and fabulous wealth, etc. So although centralized systems are an absolute disaster and have resulted from Mao to Stalin to National Socialist Germany, always horrific mass murder and starvation for the people, they don't care about that and it doesn't bother them in the least. All they're interested is the power and control and the wealth. So for them, centralized systems that they want, ironically, they do make sense. Even if there's absolute chaos and fallout, once they're insulated and they're getting the power and the control they crave, centralized systems do actually work for them.
Well, they work for them for a time, but totalitarianism always eventually fails. So it will end badly for them as well, but we will all suffer along the way. I want to cycle back to this image of the hill town and the financial services industry being the patsies set up. There's this idea that I'm sure you've heard people say that the Illuminati have this principle that they put the information out there. They don't hide it. They actually make it available. Now, why do they do that? This is a perfect example of that. By having this UCC language there for anyone to see, basically all of these people are guilty. All of the people in the financial services industry are guilty of not knowing about this or refusing to know about it, refusing to do anything about it. So by putting it there in the code, they create, and it's just so apparent. Anyone could know it. It creates the shared guilt that they like to create that condition that, look, everybody is guilty in this.
Yeah, we're all in it together, I think the phrase from the COVID era. Yeah. No, it's a fascinating story, but much more importantly, it's a current story, and our futures depend on us knowing about this story and what's actually happening. So this has been a fantastic conversation. And you know what, David? We will be absolutely circling back in another few weeks or months to find out the latest developments. And here's to more states taking this on, overcoming the obfuscators, the filthy banksters. And ultimately, here's to accelerating that final end for these totalitarians. But I think that's going to be a ways down the road, and we're going to see a lot of fireworks before that happens.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting number of years.
Absolutely. So thanks so much, David. And just a last mention, I suppose, the Great Taking website, link down below. Action with an exclamation mark for the latest stuff. And I think I'll put a link as well to the fabulous creature from Jekyll Island, which
Yes.
is just timeless and actually explains the real root of all of this madness way back nearly a century ago.
Yes. Yeah, I would highly recommend that. Thank you for doing that.
Well, thanks, David. Till next time, let's keep it real.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Igor.
Well, there you have it, folks. The Great Taking, some very, very bad people over more than a half century actually have been working towards tying us up in legal knots. But as David mentions, we've got some great hope. And South Dakota, there's been an effort to begin to highlight this, so getting a spotlight on it, and more states will follow. And I think we can win this one. But remember, we're overturning a long, long period of many decades of efforts to stitch us into a corner. So there's a lot at play, there's a lot to play for, and it's going to be very interesting to watch how this develops. And again, just briefly, I'll mention everyone's got a hedge, everyone's got to look after themselves and their family in these troubled times. And Pure Gold in London is an excellent company. I've checked them out fully. There's a link there if you wish to talk to one of their financial advisors about getting your house in order. Completely up to you, but the link does give a year's free storage while you work out other options and potentially physical ownership and holding of the actual asset itself, which is the ultimate form of safety in this world. So there you have it. The links are down below. Completely up to you. But you can take advantage of it if you wish. So thank you.